bro.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 30 years ago today, the Supreme Court declared abortion a constitutional right. The court's historic Roe v. Wade decision shook American politics to its core and continues to shake and shape American politics today. Only the battle over civil rights has been as consequential in realigning the American political map. Tonight on Point, the fiery politics of abortion and the impact of abortion on America. American politics. We begin with the abortion issue in Washington on the 30th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. William Salatin is chief political correspondent for Slate.com and the author of a forthcoming book on the politics of abortion. I asked him if there have been any surprises as the Roe v. Wade anniversary plays out in Washington, D.C.
I don't think there are surprises. This fight tends to go back and forth, and there are ebbs and flows. And what I think we've ended up with at this point in the debate is a kind of middle ground in which abortion is legal, and it's safely legal in terms of the polls and politics. That is, even if the courts allow legislatures to change policy, there really won't be abortion bans almost anywhere in the country. However, there will be a series of restrictions. There will be parental notification laws everywhere. There will be restrictions on public funding of abortions and various other kinds of restrictions. And the general layout, as I see it, is that we have a conservative pro-choice consensus in this country right now. So there will be legal abortion. You won't get other people to pay for it, and parents will have the right to decide whether their children, even children who are old enough to be pregnant, can have abortions.
I want to be sure I understand what you're saying, William Salatin. Are you suggesting that even if the court should overturn Roe v. Wade, that abortion would remain a guarantee of some kind to American women?
It would not be a guarantee. That's exactly what would be lost if Roe v. Wade were overturned. Roe v. Wade is a guarantee that no matter who gets elected to your state legislature, your legislature cannot ban abortion in your state. Once Roe v. Wade is overturned, if that were to happen, the legislature would be free to do so. However, what happened about 15 years ago was that the Supreme Court signaled to state legislatures that they could begin to restrict abortion, and the tide turned the other way because the public does not support outlawing abortion. They support restrictions, but they don't support outlawing it, and they will vote out legislators who oppose them on that issue. You know, there was an interesting moment in the NARAL celebration of the Roe v. Wade anniversary in which there was a video.
Last night in Washington, you mean?
That's right. They showed a video of Ed Rendell, who was just recently elected governor of Pennsylvania, saying that if Roe v. Wade were overturned, almost the next day the Pennsylvania legislature would outlaw abortion. Well, this is the same Ed Rendell who ran for election as governor saying that he was pro-choice, knowing that that issue would help him in Pennsylvania. So there's a little bit of disingenuousness on the side of pro-choicers. They want pro-choice people to be scared that if Roe v. Wade is overturned, that the next day abortion will be lost as a political right. That's really not true. It will be lost as a guaranteed legal right, but the political balance of power is still on the side of legal abortion.
What number of states out of the 50 do you imagine, in the absence of Roe v. Wade, might in fact outright ban abortion within their state boundaries?
Well, we have a decent experiment on that, which is back in 1989 when the Webster decision was handed down that suggested that states could go further to restrict abortion. States did debate whether to outlaw abortion. And at that point, Utah and Louisiana were the only states in which legislatures voted to ban abortion. In one case, I believe it was overturned by courts, and the other case vetoed by the governor. And we ended up with no state in which there was an abortion ban that could be carried all the way to the Supreme Court. That's really a remarkable statement of how far this country has shifted politically toward believing in legal abortion.
And yet, William Salatin, I'm quite sure that there would be people who would sharply debate the notion that that abortion availability is something that would remain widespread without the constitutional guarantee. How vulnerable do Washington observers see Roe v. Wade at this point?
Well, Roe v. Wade is only as strong as the Supreme Court majority that has stood by it, and that is very fragile, much more so than the power that abortion rights has in the polls. On the court, there are two people who are considered highly likely to resign in the next year or two. They are Supreme Court Chief Justice Bill Rehnquist and the Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. If Sandra Day O'Connor were to resign from the court, which is there's a very decent probability that that will happen, then with her pretty much goes the balance of power in terms of Roe v. Wade. That vote shifts. Suddenly, the Supreme Court would approve a ban on partial birth abortion, which is going to be the next bill to come down the pike federally. And we would have, at that point, a legal ban on an abortion procedure in this country passed by the federal government.
And the possibility of Roe v. Wade itself being overturned, of course, it's not just a GOP president, but both Republican houses in Congress now. What's going on in Congress that may further restrict abortion availability?
Well, there are several bills coming down the pike. There is a bill involving Child Custody Protection Act that's to prevent kids from crossing state lines to get abortions in other states. There's a bill that would nominally protect the fetus in the womb. It would make it virtually a homicide for you to kill a fetus inside a woman.
That is in the process of a crime.
Right, in the process of a crime. There is also the partial birth ban, which is going to be the first one that comes down the pike, and that's almost certainly going to have majorities in both houses and would be signed by President Bush. Interestingly, at the NARAL celebration last night, Kate Michelman, the head of NARAL, said that if a justice, a nominee for the Supreme Court, comes before the Senate while the Democrats are in the minority, she expects pro-choice senators to filibuster that nomination. So that would be the granddaddy of all showdowns on this issue. That would be expecting 40, 41 senators to hold together and refuse even to debate the nomination of a justice, probably simply because that nominee refuses to state a position on abortion. In other words, that person doesn't even have to say they're going to overturn Roe v. Wade. All they have to do is decline to say that they would stand by Roe v. Wade, and you would have this huge filibuster fight. That's probably the biggest fight we're going to have in the Senate for the next 2 years.
William Salatin, cast your mind back in 1972 when the Supreme Court made this historic ruling. Did anyone imagine then that 10, 20, 30 years later there would be such an enormous row, an enormous division still over the issue of abortion?
No, I think that back then judges were thought to have more authority. I really think the Supreme Court majority back then believed that once they declared that abortion was going to be a constitutional right, the country would fall in line behind them. Now, you can have a debate as to whether that's what happened, because politically, the balance of power has shifted in favor of abortion rights. But I don't think that judges have the same authority they used to. Now judges are considered just another branch of the government, just as political. We just saw in the last election, Bush v. Gore, the judges were considered purely political in how they decided the disposition of that election. And so there is an open rebellion to overturn Roe v. Wade and to throw out these justices so that that can be done.
William Salatin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
William Salatin is chief political correspondent for Slate.com. He spoke with us earlier from Washington. Thirty years ago today, the Supreme Court decided in Roe v. Wade to make abortion a constitutional right. The 7-2 ruling set off a firestorm of controversy over the right to life and a woman's right to choose. Tonight, we're talking about the politics of abortion and the impact of the unending abortion battle on the structure of American politics. Has abortion planted religion at the center of contemporary American politics? Is Roe v. Wade behind the red and blue states of America's political landscape? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Adrian Wooldridge, Washington correspondent for The Economist. Good evening and welcome, Adrian Wooldridge.
Good evening.
And with us tonight from Berkeley, California, Cynthia Gorney, Associate Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of Articles of Faith, A Frontline History of the Abortion Wars. She reported for The Washington Post from 1975 to 1991. Good evening and welcome, Cynthia Gorney.
Nice to be with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Adrian Wooldridge, you have written that Roe v. Wade may have liberated many American women, but it has also trapped America in an irresolvable clash of absolutes. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that America is very peculiar over abortion. This debate is not going on in anything like the same way in Europe. This is regarded in Europe as an issue which is more or less settled. In America, it's something that goes on. It's a perpetual debate. I'm sure in 10 years' time, people will still be debating this clash of absolutes between, on the one hand, the right to choose, on the other hand, the right of life. And I think the reason for that is the way that America went about legalizing abortion. Other European countries went around this process essentially through the legislature. They went around it through majority opinion. America went around it through this declaration by the Supreme Court of this right that it discovered in the Constitution, and that really created a firestorm of controversy which I think cannot be resolved.
Cynthia Gorney, there it is. Adrian Wooldridge lays it out as a perpetual conflict in the United States because it was handed down as if, you know, carved in stone tablets by the Supreme Court instead of hashed out in legislatures. But can you imagine, do you think, that abortion availability would have become the norm in the United States had it not been for the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade?
It's a very interesting question. The analysis that Adrian gives is one that that commands a great deal of respect among people who have followed this history. One of the things, of course, that one of the many things that distinguishes the United States from many of the European countries is the power of individual state legislatures, the size of the country, and the geographical travail that was involved in the pre-1973 Roe v. Wade years. For a woman who lived in a state, for example, in the Midwest, where it was illegal to get to a state like California or New York, where it was legal. The diversity of passion and opinion from state to state between the years 1967 and 1973, when it first began to be legalized state by state, until the Supreme Court declared that it was going to have to be legal everywhere, was tremendous. And it is a very difficult retrospective question to know whether it would ultimately have been legalized by every state legislature or whether it would have remained the kind of patchwork that it was for a long time. It is definitely the case that the breadth and depth of Roe v. Wade and the declaration that it was not only to be legal in every state but couldn't even really be regulated very much in states took both sides completely by surprise in 1973.
And Adrian Wooldridge, you say in the surprise, in the response to the handing down by the judiciary of this decision, lie the seeds of enormous political upheaval, even if it came from the judiciary. How would you describe, now 30 years on, the impact of the ongoing abortion debate battle over the shape of American politics today?
Absolutely. I just wanted to come back on the point about the patchwork. If you look at Europe, for example, I mean, abortion starts really to be legalized in Europe in Britain, I think, in 1967. The most recent European country to legalize abortion was Switzerland. So Europe loses the sort of absolute immediacy and it loses the uniformity that America has. It's a much slower process. It's an incremental process.
And a very different continent and population and different religious views.
But what you always see, what you see throughout Europe is once the decision is taken, because it's taken by the legislature, by the majority of people, it has the dignity and the force of democracy behind it, that the debate in all of those countries, very, very different countries, but in all of those countries, it really disappears. It's really pushed to the periphery of society.
Because it hasn't been handed down from on high.
Yes, because it has the legitimacy of democratic approval behind it. That doesn't happen in America. And because that doesn't happen in America, there is a sort of tenuousness about the decision. One side is the side of the anti-abortion people are furious because they think this represents a misreading of the Constitution. And the pro-abortion people are very, very nervous because they think this right, which they hold so dear, is a tenuous right that depends just upon the balance of power on the Supreme Court, which could change at any moment.
But when we look at the larger political picture, would you draw a line from the 1972 decision to the ever greater centrality of religion and religious issues in American politics?
Absolutely. I think that it changes the nature, it helps to change the nature of the Republican Party. It makes the Republican Party less just the party of the professional and business elites, much more the party of people whose values are conservative and religious. And it also, you know, helps to drive out many of those people from the Democratic Party, white working class voters who you know, ethnic minorities, people who are religious. They feel themselves alienated from what has been their traditional politics, and it replaces in many ways the politics of class, which was the basis of the Roosevelt coalition in the Democratic Party, with the politics of values, in which religion or anti-religion or skepticism about religion are central.
Right at the heart of the debate. Cynthia Gorney, I want to get your view. We've got to take a short break first. We're talking tonight about the politics of abortion and abortion's impact On American Politics, how large does the abortion issue loom in your political calculations? Have you voted for politicians who disagree with you on abortion? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Today, on the 30th anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, we're talking about the politics of abortion and abortion's impact on American politics. You can join the conversation. Why is America so endlessly torn over abortion? And how important is abortion, in your mind, in dividing political America into those red states and blue states that we've all seen on the big map? My guests tonight are Cynthia Gorney. She's Associate Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California and author of Articles of Faith, A Frontline History of the Abortion Wars, and Adrian Wooldridge, Washington correspondent for The Economist. His article, The War That Never Ends, Abortion in America, appeared in the January 18th issue of The Economist. Cynthia Gorney, I want to get you in here on the politics of abortion in the U.S. today and on how the abortion debate has and continues to shape American politics writ large.
One of the things that's not commonly known is the extent to which Republican planners and strategists set out quite deliberately in the late 1970s to draw in what they regarded as a non-politicized constituency of white working class and middle class, both Catholics, Catholic Democrats, but also, more to the point, Protestants. There was a huge influx into this issue of Protestants who became part of a really conservative, socially conservative Protestant movement. Mm-hmm. And abortion was regarded as, if not one of the, probably the key issue that would pull people in, when the central issues in the minds of some of these organizers really had to do with things that were a lot more abstruse and not very sexy, like tax policy and the U.S. policy toward Taiwan.
So you're saying this was a Republican, seen by Republicans as an opening to bring Protestant fundamentalists, I guess, deeper into the Republican fold.
The idea being people are going to get much more excited about abortion and the sanctity of life than they are about the U.S. posture toward Taiwan, which
and
is
has it worked?
On the agenda as well.
Has it worked as a policy?
Absolutely. It created an enormous constituency. It transferred the bulk of activity and force in the American Right to Life movement from the Catholic Church, which had produced many of the parish organizations and most active, effective volunteers prior to the late 1970s. Those groups began to be dominated by Protestant groups, which regarded abortion as part of a link of social issues that they were concerned about that included homosexuality, the women's movement, mm-hmm. a great many other things that they saw as the fraying of the American fabric, a very different linkage than many of the early Catholics had made.
And let me ask you this, Cynthia Gorney. We heard at the top of the hour from William Salatin from Slate.com and a bit from Adrian Wooldridge as well, the view that if Roe v. Wade should be overturned, and it well could be by a Bush-appointed court in the next 5-6 years, that state legislatures would still uphold the availability, by and large, of abortion. Given the kind of change that you're describing right now, are you as confident of that?
Yeah. I think it's very hard to predict from state to state. But I do believe, Justice Salatin said, that what would probably happen in nearly every one of these states is a number of legislators who have voted pro-life for a long time because it was a safe vote. In other words, you could look like a pro-life legislator, get the support of your very ardent pro-life lobbyists,
right,
and keep abortion legal in your state, would probably chicken out if the vote was really, are we making abortion illegal? Because the rise of outrage among their own constituency, people who have never really thrown anything into this but suddenly realize that their daughters and sisters and aunts aren't going to be able to get abortions in the state, would be tremendous.
Adrian Wooldridge, are you equally confident? As you say, the abortion issue and that polarization itself has helped drum up and fuel the organization of religious-based political constituencies. Might they not go state by state in their considerable power and fight abortion at the state level?
Well, absolutely. I think that it's vital to the rise of the Christian right in this country. You have to remember that in 1976, the majority of evangelical Christians voted for Jimmy Carter. There's a shift that goes on in the late 1970s, because the Republicans have worked out that you can really use this issue to move evangelicals out of the Democratic Party into the Republican Party. And
of course,
also,
Jimmy Carter was the born-again presidential candidate of that day, but a very different kind of born-again candidate from George W. Bush.
Yes, absolutely. But I think that he disappointed his constituents, but also I think the Republicans worked out that you could use this issue of abortion to unite people who, in many ways, were very divided, evangelicals and Roman Catholics, for lots of reasons.
Had not historically been allies.
They've not been allies. They've quite often been extremely hostile. Mm-hmm. And this managed to bring these two people together, so they buried their differences because they thought that this was such an appalling decision that had been made. And I think that this has been clearly an extremely powerful force in American politics, remains quite a powerful force in American politics.
Reshaping along cultural and regional lines. Adrian Wooldridge, mm-hmm. Cynthia Gorney, please stand by. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to begin to invite them in. Don's calling from Warren, Pennsylvania. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I was just trying to let you guys know, like, you guys are saying how the Republicans are using this to steal votes or, you know, whatever.
I don't think we're saying steal votes, Don, but I think the view is that it has reshaped the political landscape, certainly.
Right, and I say that's me exactly. I come from a working-class family. I'm 24 mm-hmm. years old now, and I was always taught to vote Democratic, but because of the pro-choice and the anti-abortion issue, I've switched almost all my votes to just Republican, just because of that issue.
On the single issue of abortion,
right? Like I don't even like I don't listen to like all the commercials of what they're running for. I just get a list of the politicians that are anti-abortionist or at least pro-life.
Right.
Politicians, and I vote for them, you know, because...
Don, may I ask you a question? Did you have a kind of religious conversion experience that led you to this? Did you get deeper into religion before you changed from Democrat to Republican around abortion, or was this a religious view you've always held?
I'd say it's something I've always held. I didn't, like, you know, just all of a sudden get religious at my voting age. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know that one party, like, I didn't know the differences between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. I didn't really care, you know, what the differences were. But when I found out that the Republicans were, you know, making a move toward pro-life or anti-abortion, that's the only thing that swayed my vote.
That defines it for you. Don, thank you for calling. Cynthia Gorney, here it is in a nutshell. Self-described working class Don, a young man, was not around listening to the 1972 debate, but now voting entirely based on the abortion issue and voting Republican.
Traditionally in this country, there's only one other constituency in the last 30 years that has the single-minded dedication that the Right to Life constituency does, and that's the anti-gun control constituency.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, particularly during the 1970s and 80s, and I think this will flare up again now, people who believe that legal abortion is the killing of innocent babies believe this very passionately, believe it's more important than any other issue they could possibly vote on, and are willing to discard often everything else they think about a particular candidate just to make that choice, as the caller just indicated.
It's a kind of an amazing dynamic that the cause now championed by Democrats would also be so strengthening for Republicans, Adrian Wooldridge.
Well, I think there's an interesting paradox here, because the Republicans, this is in some ways a very useful position for the Republicans. It brings in a lot of working class voters mm-hmm. who they wouldn't naturally appeal to on the basis of tax cuts and the rest of it. But nevertheless, their position depends on frustrating these people, because as soon as they actually give them what they want, which is the overturn of Roe versus Wade and if possible, legislation or a Supreme Court judgment that would make abortion illegal, they would actually face a gigantic backlash. A huge backlash, because ultimately, as one of your people was saying earlier, America is conservatively pro-abortion. So they must always offer a little bit, always offer something to the pro-life movement, but never give them the ultimate prize, because
this
would be politically devastating.
Though this administration has given a lot around the edges, including resistance to talk about abortion in international programs, cutting off U.S. funding.
But isn't it interesting that it should be abroad rather than here? They will always give a little bit. They will always give something around the edges, particularly, and it's particularly useful to do something in the world of economic international development, because that doesn't really affect constituencies.
And yet, while that goes on, as you say, the issue is shaping the entire polity. Annie's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Annie. You're on the air.
Hi. I want to say that I was around during the 1973 announcement of Roe versus Wade, mm-hmm. and I was so euphoric. I still remember how exciting it was to have this decision come down. And I don't like to see the U.S. Supreme Court and Roe versus Wade made the heavy and being made to take the fault for the division. I think the problem here, the heavies, are organized religion, the Roman Catholic lobby, the bishops, the Southern Baptists, the Mormons, and all the crazy faith-based zealots out there who won't let this issue drop. And I think that Mr. Woldridge needs to know that in my state of Wisconsin, although we had a federal decision overturning our anti-abortion law in 1971, our anti-abortion law, which is incredibly punitive, is still on our state statutes. It has never been repealed by our Catholic-dominated legislature.
So you're not so confident in the absence of Roe v. Wade, you'd have abortion in Wisconsin.
And I want to point out that in Europe, there is still great problems with access to abortion in Catholic-dominated religious countries, such as Ireland, Poland, and Portugal.
Mm-hmm.
And I see the problem here. The problem is organized religion and its attempt to control women. I do not object to our Supreme Court and our system of justice in this country.
I don't hear anyone objecting to the system of justice or the Supreme Court, simply pointing out that it has been a tremendously galvanizing kind of battle point for organized religion.
We needed that court in Wisconsin. Without it, we still wouldn't have legal abortion. And as your woman reporter pointed out, our country was incredibly divided, and you cannot have that kind of situation without the court intervening. It does it in every other case. Why shouldn't it have done it with abortion?
Well, it did it, and the consequences in many directions have been large. Annie, thank you very much for your call. Cynthia Gorney, what about this deeper issue of women's rights? Is this, if we talk at a deep political level, a conversation about women's place in society, about that, because of course the free reproductive choice is an extraordinarily empowering choice?
Well, one of the great conundrums of this issue is that what it's about at its deeper level shifts dramatically depending on sort of what corner of the room you're standing in.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, people like Annie, and there are many millions of them in this country, feel passionately that this is fundamentally about women's rights. The difficulty is that the passion of the constituency on the other side comes in some large part from the conviction that they are defending people who need defending. There is certainly a strain in the right to life movement in this country of distress about what's happened to the role of women, and a feeling that the proper sphere of women as homemakers and mothers has really been diminished and trashed by legal abortion. But that's not the essence of it by any means at all.
The essence being, let's save these individual lives.
Exactly.
Mm. Cindy Gorney, Adrian Woldridge, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Teresa Wagner. She joins us tonight from Washington. She's editor of Back to the Drawing Board, The Future of the Pro-Life Movement. Good evening and welcome, Teresa Wagner.
I'm so happy to be here.
Thanks very much for joining us. Teresa Wagner, you have been a pro-life advocate, an anti-abortion worker in the vineyards for a long time. Many in the pro-abortion camp or pro-choice camp express a lot of concern about what's going on in Congress now that there's GOP controlling both houses, looking at the Bush administration, what it's saying. There's been a lot of talk about the vulnerability of Roe v. Wade. You, however, are on record as saying not enough is being done, that the conservative forces in U.S. politics are not taking advantage of the power of the moment that they have.
Well, my position is that there's a real divide between the people who are making the policy, which is to say the legal profession, versus the culture. And your first interviewee, William Salatin, I thought in some ways he had it wrong, because the legal profession is very supportive of abortion, and as long as judges are making our abortion policy, obviously they will be in favor of abortion, but the public at large, the cultural scene, is much more ambivalent. And I see signs of hope in that ambivalence, because we have had over the past 30 years, I think everyone would agree, the support for abortion from the legal institutions, to a large extent the medical elite, Hollywood, of course, is a given, and also the mass media. But
Teresa, I want to look at that cultural piece, but first, I want to just make sure I understand what you mean on the judiciary front. We are now within a very slight margin of changing the Supreme Court position on this. That seems to me to suggest that the judiciary is not as rock solid in favor of abortion as you suggest.
Well, the most recent decision on abortion was the Stenberg case involving the partial birth abortion method, but that Supreme Court decision was really mimicking probably 20 judicial opinions that preceded it from lower federal courts, and 18 of those 20 opinions decided that the partial birth abortion method could receive constitutional protection, even though I think everybody would agree for that particular angle of the abortion issue, there was pretty much consensus within the American public that that method went too far. That's why you had 30 states move to outlaw it. But every time it went to court, challenged by the abortion advocates, the judges sided with the abortion advocates. And when I say the legal profession, I'm not just talking about the courts, although the courts are a pretty good reflection of it. I'm talking about the law schools, which are overwhelmingly supportive of abortion in their faculty, as well as the bar associations. You know, when we have these fights about judicial nominations, I often want to ask, well, folks, where do you think these judges come from? They've been groomed for years in academia and in the law schools where support for abortion is extremely high.
So, but Teresa Wagner, in your view, if this is handed back by the Supreme Court to the legislature,
yes,
if Roe v. Wade is overturned and
yes,
it goes back to individual state legislatures, you're disagreeing with what had been the consensus until you joined us, that those legislatures would uphold abortion availability.
I'm disagreeing with that. Yes, I think that you're underestimating, although your first caller sort of illustrated this, and I think Cynthia Gorney pointed this out, the intensity among voters is very much with the pro-life citizen who votes passionately in almost single issue on this question. I think it's going to be a state-by-state thing, and that highlights the importance for the pro-life movement and for its so-called leaders. You know, and I say that with a grain of salt because I do not think that the Republican Party has adequately met its pro-life pledge, which exists in the platform. It's incumbent upon us, given the ambivalence within the culture, to actually speak about this in persuasive and compassionate terms so that, you know, Cynthia Gorney referred to the sisters and daughters and women who would revolt. Those are the people I want to talk to because I think reasonable people, especially reasonable women who are more sensitive to the needs of children, obviously, these are the women that we need to reach who can't ignore anymore because the biological and scientific evidence are just so undeniable that another human life here is at stake, and that we can do better than killing that human life by abortion.
But it sounds as though you're not at all afraid of the political battlefield and ready to take on the issue there if the Supreme Court passes it there.
Right. Well, the point is there's ambivalence here despite real support for abortion, I mean, incredible sympathy for abortion within very powerful and prestigious institutions.
Teresa Wagner, we've got it, and I know we have to let you go. I want to thank you so much for joining us. Teresa Wagner is editor of Back to the Drawing Board, The Future of the Pro-Life Movement. We're talking about the politics of abortion and abortion's impact on American politics. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the politics of abortion and abortion's impact on American politics. Does a personal position on abortion automatically decide party affiliation today? And which party is winning the abortion war? Has Roe v. Wade entangled church and state in America in a new way? And was it necessary to politicize the womb? Was there any other way? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Adrian Wooldridge, Washington correspondent for The Economist, and Cynthia Gorney, author of Articles of Faith, A Frontline History of the Abortion Wars. I want to welcome to our conversation right now Jennifer Stockman. She's joining us from Greenwich, Connecticut. She's co-chair of the Republican Pro-Choice Coalition. Good evening and welcome, Jennifer Stockman.
Hello. Happy to be here tonight.
Thanks for joining us. Jennifer, explain to us the Republican perspective that you represent in this big conversation, political and otherwise.
We represent the Republican pro-choice constituency in our party, which is actually the party is divided pretty evenly between the anti-choice community and the pro-choice community. As was earlier discussed in mm-hmm. one of your conversations, the anti-choice community tends to vote exclusively on this issue, while the pro-choicers, if you will, are moderates mm-hmm. and tend not to be identified with any single issue. Even in exit polls, when a pro-choicer might be asked why they voted for Governor Pataki or whomever, they would say probably the economy or taxes and not necessarily say because he's pro-choice.
So you're saying the Republican Party may be the pro-life party, but within its ranks it's not monolithic. How does that break down, Jennifer Stockman, among Republican men and Republican women?
Believe it or not, there are more pro, as they call, you know, we're pro-life as well, too, but they've sort of won the nomenclature battle
yes,
on that. There are more pro-life women in the party today than there are pro-life men, interestingly enough. Those numbers are still very small.
So you're saying more Republican men would support abortion than Republican women?
Left in the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for this phenomena is that women have been leaving the Republican Party in droves and either becoming independents or Democrats.
So when you hear Teresa Wagner say that if the Supreme Court passes this back down to the legislatures, state legislatures of America, she is confident that her anti-abortion culture will reject abortion, do you agree?
I believe that the general electorate is pro-choice, and that voters will never reject abortion. It's a basic, fundamental civil right. And I think if Roe versus Wade was overturned or it ever went back to the states, I think we would see a civil rights movement in our country that we've never experienced before.
So what do you say to your Republican leadership that has in many ways benefited from the new stratification around abortion, the new polarization around abortion? Does the GOP have itself in a long-term bind here? We're already reading and hearing tonight that President Bush can make nice noises about opposing abortion, but is afraid to substantially act against it.
Because the general electorate is clearly on the pro-choice side, and the Republican Party, if they continue to be bully boyed by this small faction in our party, we'll be on a collision course with this general electorate.
Cynthia Gorney,
and Karl Rove understand these numbers.
Cynthia Gorney, what do you hear in Jennifer Stockman's perspective? She's a Republican woman, she's pro-choice, and she doesn't buy the persuasive power of the numbers on the anti-abortion side in the Republican Party.
She's in very good company. I know that there is a great deal of turmoil about this issue within the Republican Party, and that there are many Republicans who say that government interference in the private matters of one's procreation is precisely the opposite of what republicanism is supposed to stand for.
Absolutely.
The question is, I don't think it's clear to anybody at this point what the true believer breakdown is in the U.S. Congress among Republicans, because they've never had to test it. And by that I mean the people who would go ahead and vote for extremely restrictive anti-abortion legislation, even if they knew it was going to cost them votes, rather than the ones who just keep putting their fingers to the wind and trying to figure out what the right thing is to do.
Jennifer Stockman, can you imagine an explicit change in the GOP position on abortion, I don't know, under George W. Bush in the next decade?
I don't think we're going to see it in the year 2004. I think it's pretty well set in concrete that the plank in the Republican platform is not going to change. He is, completely in cahoots with that faction of our party. But I do think that we're going to see change in the next 3 to 7 years.
Jennifer Stockman, thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Jennifer Stockman is co-chair of the Republican Pro-Choice Coalition. Adam's calling from Medford, Massachusetts. Hi, Adam. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I believe Adrian, your guest, is an author of a recent piece on this subject in The Economist.
Yes, he is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been following it. And in that article, he or the staff, they mentioned that they don't believe that any substantive change is in the wind, just as you've been discussing recently,
mm-hmm.
and mentions that in addition to Roe v. Wade, there have been a number of other rulings, all of which have upheld a woman's right to choose.
In lower courts.
I was sort of fascinated by this and wondered if perhaps you could discuss that in terms of its effect. I mean, I myself agree with Jennifer. I don't think there's going to be anything really going to happen. And if it does get thrown back to the states,
Yes, I mean, I don't think anything,
Adrian Wooldridge.
I don't think anything will happen on two levels, because I don't actually think that the Supreme Court will reverse itself on this on this ruling, because I think it's partly because it's been on the statute books for so long, and partly because I think to reverse itself on such an important thing that is so integral to people's planning and decision making will actually undermine the authority of the court. So I think they will leave this basic judgment intact. I don't also think that the president would want to take the political flak that would come from trying to put somebody on the Supreme Court who was really determined to overturn Roe versus Wade.
And yet there are millions of Americans, and many of them in the Republican Party, that devoutly believe that this change can and should come.
Well, absolutely. But as I was saying earlier, the paradox of all of this is that the Republican Party's position depends on keeping those people within the Republican coalition, keeping their energy, keeping their enthusiasm, but ultimately denying them the ultimate prize, because to give them the ultimate prize, or even to try really, really hard to give them the ultimate prize, would produce a gigantic backlash, because fundamentally the average middle-of-the-road voter in this country wants to have the right to abortion there as a safety net against if something goes wrong in the lives of their
Can I suggest a likelier scenario, possibly?
Yes, Cynthia Gorney?
The composition of the court changes, somebody retires, you get a majority on the court that is not so adamantly in support of Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. But just as Adrian says, the court once again is unwilling to completely reverse itself in this matter. So instead what happens is the piece of legislation now in the Congress called the Partial Birth Abortion Act is passed by the Congress, the president signs it. This act prohibits a specific procedure on the grounds, basically, to put it crudely, that it's too gruesome to be born by American society. They take care of the problems the court had with this the last time around. It goes up before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ducks the central Roe v. Wade issue, but upholds this act, and in doing so, essentially says in its ruling, there are procedures that are so nasty to think about that we find them not to be protected by the Constitution. When that happens, the reason that's dangerous in the pro-choice view is that that takes care of not only the procedure that is referred to by one side as partial birth abortion, it also takes care of basically every abortion procedure past about 12 weeks, because if you get into the mechanics of how those are done, they're just as nasty as the thing called partial birth abortion.
So you can imagine a narrowing of the window, and a significant narrowing of the window, which would not constitute a rejection outright of abortion.
And this, interestingly, brings us much closer. This would be a big, big deal in U.S. abortion practice as it exists at present. Mm-hmm. But it would bring us much more in line with the way abortion is actually practiced in Europe.
Which brings us just about full circle. And with that, I'm sorry to say we are out of time. Cynthia Gorney, it's been great having you tonight. Thank you for joining us. Cynthia Gorney is Associate Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California and author of Articles of Faith, A Frontline History of the Abortion Wars. And Adrian Wooldridge, thank you for your wonderful reporting, and thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Adrian Wooldridge is Washington correspondent for The Economist. You can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. This is On Point. When independent producer Ari Birnbaum set out to produce a documentary about people who have been affected by abortion, she wanted to get past the anger that often surrounds the issue. The result, Shades of Gray, is airing on public radio stations across the country this month. Birnbaum kept meticulous notes in her journal as she created the documentary. In this radio diary, she shares some of the entries and the whirlwind of emotions the project stirred in her.
November 15th, 2002. Sitting on a blood and urine specimen box. I wait for the women's center to open. This is where the doctor will tell me about his work. Critical piece of the documentary puzzle. Sitting outside the room where abortions are performed. A daily practice. Daily opportunities for renewal. Daily death. Starting over. This is a safe, clean room where abortions happen. How many people talk about abortion without actually knowing what happens? I cannot leave today without this tape.
It's done under local anesthesia, so they won't be asleep during the procedure. We clean the vagina and cervix with some antiseptic solution. We give an injection of some numbing medicine in the cervix. There's a little cramp when we give that. And then this is the suction machine. The procedure itself usually takes a minute or so. You know, of course, there is another aspect to this, and I always do kind of, in a way, have a moment's thought of thinking of the end of this fetus. Not in that I think of this as a life necessarily, but it's a loss.
November 20th. I found the woman who will tell me about her illegal abortion in the late 60s. Do people actually know what it was like for women before Roe was passed? Maybe just the women themselves. When I walk in, she greeted me with a big hug. Immediately, there was trust between us. We walked over to the couch. I sat on the floor looking up at her, and she was lying down with pillows to prop her up. My head was near hers. Our eyes were connected. The tape began to roll.
We walked for about 6 or 8 blocks to this dilapidated brownstone. And the woman who opened the door was, she was holding a bottle of Canadian Club. And I just remember thinking, oh, God, here we go again. And she just said, come on in. And get up on the table. I mean, no kind of prelude, nothing. Just get up on the table.
I've got abortion on my brain. This work is brutal, brutal and critical to American consciousness. I fear the pomposity of our government. I fear that young women don't know what happened before Planned Parenthood and before Roe versus Wade. I fear the real stories of abortions have been lost and mutilated by political agendas of both sides. These are power struggles that have nothing to do with people and their many truths inside abortion. Dialogue and compassion are what we need around this extremely pervasive and silent issue. Is it possible? How are we going to do this and make it work? November 21st. Jonathan's my co-producer, and we met for lunch today. We think it should be presented as a mosaic without narration, complete anonymity. Does it matter who's speaking? We're all people, and this issue affects everyone, whether directly or indirectly. Everyone knows someone, or has been through it, or has read an article. Real voices in first person, regardless of their political views, and carefully woven together with Jonathan's original music score in a stew of ideas and reality. Yes, this is the only way we can make it work.
Ari Birnbaum is an independent radio producer living in San Francisco. Her documentary, Shades of Grey, airs this month on public radio stations across the country. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.